Hey, folks. Today's episode brought to you by SunsetLakeSabade.com. Use the code LEFTISBEST for 20% off. 20% off what, Sam? Well, things like smokables, things like kief, flower, or edibles like gummies to help you sleep, gummies to help you relax, gummies with a little THC in them. Or you could have Sabade fudge or Sabade coffee or lotions. Lotions to help hydrate your skin. Lotions or salves to help your sore muscles or your eczema if you want to use it off-label. They have all sorts of great Sabade products. And the best thing about it is not only that they don't use pesticides and they're growing, they use integrated pest management. Not only do they have great farming practices, but they are movement partners. You're helping support a company that has donated tens of thousands of dollars to things like strike relief funds and refugee resettlement and carceral reform and Planned Parenthood and Give Directly. The list goes on and on. Food pantries. They've engaged in mutual aid up in Vermont in the wake of the floods a couple of years ago. Just an all-around great company. Great farming practices, great business practices, mostly employee owned. Check them out. SunsetLakeSabade.com. Use the coupon code LEFTISBEST and they'll give you 20% off. And now, time for the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, February 13th. 2026. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect, co-host of the Organized Money podcast, to look back on this week that was, as it were. Also on the program today, DHS shutdown all but happening tonight with, at this point, no end in sight. Trump very determined to have his secret Gestapo force, and Republicans seem quite okay with that. Meanwhile, the Trump regime totally erases the government's power to fight climate change. Former Obama White House counsel and top Goldman Sachs lawyer resigns over the Epstein files. Inflation cools. Meanwhile, the New York Fed puts out a report saying Americans have paid for virtually all of Trump's tariffs. It's a secret tax. Judge blocks Hegseth's attempt from punishing Senator Kelly for producing a video encouraging military personnel to follow the Constitution. DOJ antitrust chief fired on the brink of massive mergers. White House using U.S. AID funds to pay for Russ Vought's security. That Tulsi Gabbard whistleblower. Apparently, the complaint was based on intercepted conversations about Jared Kushner. Moderna, in the wake of the FDA, not even reviewing its application for an mRNA flu vaccine, ends its investments in phase three vaccine trials, shelves vaccine for Epstein-Barr, herpes, shingles, and other viruses. 11,000 New York City nurses are back to work after contract approval. Meanwhile, 4,000 of those 15,000 that went on strike, 4,000 from the Presbyterian Hospital, they rejected their contract. And in Nevada, 74 sex workers fight to become the first in U.S. to unionize. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Emma Vigeland, still out, on the mend, anticipating her return on Monday.
Yeah, unlike RFK, we take germs seriously here.
I take germs seriously.
You saw that, right?
I don't know what you're talking. He was doing, what was it? He was doing a blow
off a toilet,
off a toilet seat. I mean, I don't. I don't know. I mean, I guess if you wash your hands afterwards.
Not like he has an important job or anything.
Yeah. I mean, who? Is he? He's not doing that still, is he?
I don't know. His blood pressure looks pretty high.
He looks like he's really excited. I lost that email. I wanted just to give a heads up. We have a link in the podcast and YouTube and at majority.fm for a survey. If you are 18 years or older and you voted for Mamdani, a high school kid who listens to the program from Frank Sinatra High School is doing his an AP course, I think, in government, and has a survey up. So if you are were a voter in New York City over the age of 18, you voted for Mamdani, you're from one of the five boroughs, head over there and help a kid out who is who's doing a really interesting project. It's very exciting when we hear from high school students, really any type of young people doing this kind of stuff. And then I start to feel like, did I screw up as a dad? Like my kid,
you know, that organizer we met at that Mamdani rally.
Yes.
In Manhattan.
I run into this problem quite a bit. There's a lot of times, I mean, and my daughter's she's doing great right now. She's like she's a voracious reader, and she's got, I'm not going to brag about my kid getting a 3.6 GPA through her junior year, right? I did not get that when I was a college.
Nor did I.
So go over, and if you are one of those voters, it's going to take you about 10, 15 minutes to fill out that survey, but it would really help. But obviously don't do it unless you are a voter because, you know, you don't want to screw up the guy's stuff. Great job by Matt yesterday. Says no sleep till.
Thank you.
And looks like Emma wasn't listening when Sam taught the crew about Wally Pipp. Wally Pipp filled in. Wally Pipp was the guy who took the day off when Sandy Koufax took over.
Oh. Yep.
It's mentioned down here like once every 2 months.
Exactly. It's the one story I know. This is a big deal. The Trump administration is the fundamental building block of dealing with climate change was the EPA finding that greenhouse gases were a form of pollution. And almost all of the U.S. government's regulatory actions to inhibit climate change have been born out of that finding, whether it's CAFE standards for vehicles or emissions standards for factories or the idea that we're going to create a mechanism to discourage the use of coal and build upon sustainable and regenerative power, on and on. And the Trump administration did away with this yesterday. And in many instances, U.S. corporations may or may not change what they're doing because of it, because most of them recognize that climate change is real and that the body politic does, and that this is going to get reversed. But it's going to be a field day for some places. And I will just note that, like, it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago when the right was saying, why should we do anything when China is such a problem? And within those 5 years, like, China has now overcome Ford in terms of producing EVs and has seriously started to whittle down its emissions.
Yeah, to the extent that it may have peaked early.
Here is Stuart Vanni and Doug Burgum excited about the prospect of drill, baby, drill.
According to the Wall Street Journal, President Trump is set to repeal the 2009 endangerment finding, which will end the regulation of greenhouse gases virtually. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum rejoins us this morning. Mr. Secretary, is this the last nail in the coffin for the Democrats' Green New Deal?
Stuart, this is fantastic news. Under President Trump's leadership and our great EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin, this is historic. This is going to be the largest cutting of red tape ever by an administration. This endangerment finding was on top of it, was a house of cards. This knocks over the whole thing. This has been since the Obama administration forward. There's been 20 years of cost placed on the American consumer, but it wasn't like they had a chance to vote on it. It wasn't like Congress had a chance to have a say. I mean, the cost of whether it was your automobile that you were driving or the gas heater that you were putting in your home, any of these things just raised the cost on American consumers without their choice. And then some states following suit and then banning consumer choice and saying it must be a certain type of product, that, like, it has to be electric, it can't be natural gas. All of these things driven by the endangerment finding. This is a huge, huge break for every American. This is part of President Trump making things affordable again in this country, and a policy of energy abundance and energy dominance. I mean, this is just a massive change.
First off, in the main, the U.S. consumer does not get to choose the prices, and it's really up to what is driving the most amount of profit at any point. What we also will lose is the capacity to assess the cost of these things, the cost of wildfires, the cost of flooding, the cost associated with extreme weather events, the cost associated with cancers and asthma and health. None of that is on the ledger. Or, you know, the future of the planet. None of that's on the ledger. This is the ultimate in borrowing against the future and looking at one side of the ledger. Now, so some things may be cheaper. If we didn't have regulations on, let's say, cars, I'm not even talking CAFE standards, but like that you need to have functioning brakes, you could probably get cheaper cars. Once I had a libertarian call in and say, like, they should have just kept selling the Ford Pinto and people would just get a cheaper car with the chance that occasionally it might blow up.
You might be the opening scene of Casino.
Right. I mean, it's just possible. You know, somebody bumps into the back of you and poof, you just get the luck of the draw. But that's where we're at. Here is Donald Trump also bragging about this. He's getting an award?
Yeah.
Yeah, the day after they announced this, he's getting an award as the undisputed champion of clean, beautiful coal.
Oh, yeah. Here we go. The biggest question about this is, like, what coal magnate paid him $1 million?
Well, actually, I'll just go back to Burgum here, who people should know is a billionaire because he did a deal with Bill Gates, and he's a tech guy. So this coal stuff is not just for coal miners. It's actually for tech guys who want to burn coal to power their AI machines.
Play this.
Sir, to show our appreciation, the trophy says the undisputed champion of beautiful clean coal. Thank you, sir.
Trump touching the crotch of a different kind of miner.
Yeah. As if there's a, the reason why he's the undisputed champion of beautiful clean coal is because there's no one else vying for that title.
Yeah, ridiculous. Doesn't even apply.
There was a right winger. There was a right winger who was on Albany Radio years ago. I think he's on XM now, and I can't remember what his name was. It had something to do with not man cow, but something like that. Andrew somebody. And his opening was the undisputed champion of the second wave of conservative talkers. I was like, okay. Here's Lee Zeldin, former New York politician, complete lunatic. He is now the EPA administrator. He does not believe in climate change. Again, this has nothing to do with the Green New Deal insofar as 17 years after this finding by the EPA to allow for dealing with mitigating the problems of climate change, we never had a Green New Deal. This is about essentially just being able to fight climate change. Here's Lee Zeldin.
You believe that the talk of climate change is a hoax?
When you're putting forth tens of billions of dollars to pay off your well-connected former Obama and Biden admin officials and Democratic donors, wasting taxpayer dollars, yeah, that's a problem. Trillions of dollars of regulation and costs on American families, that's a big problem. It has been a con job of using this for more power and control. For example, they push environmental justice. They appropriate a dollar, and rather than remediating an environmental issue with it, they want to spend the dollar on an activist group to train other activists to come be activists and advocate in D.C. to get more money so that they could advocate.
Sounds circular.
To wrap your head around the way the money's wasted.
These waters run deep. That's what I take from all this. Sir, thank you. You believe.
These waters run deep.
This glass does as well.
We're running a lot deeper soon.
Zeldin is a longtime climate change denier. And he won't. He sort of avoids saying it specifically there because he realizes how bad that sounds.
Burgum is a guy who says that carbon isn't a pollutant and also that we should invest in carbon capture technology. So these are all liars.
Yes. But that's where we're at. It's just put it on the list of things that are going to have to be reversed. And we were already 5, 10, 15 years, 20 years too late in terms of climate change. And this is not just going to inhibit our ability to mitigate climate change. This is going to inhibit our ability to adapt to climate change. So it's going to be a disaster, but like many of these things, it's going to be a disaster years out from when it happens. And in a way that our society seems incapable of drawing a direct line from and to. In a moment, we're going to be talking to David Dayan about some other horrors of the past week. But first, a word from our sponsor. Well, a word from me about our sponsor. Right now, and for a while, we've been experiencing near spastic economic uncertainty thanks to technology, politics. The New York Fed today say that U.S. consumers paying virtually all of the tariffs. The various crypto and dollar markets, etc., Many of us are probably underinsured, overpaying, and underprotected, especially if your policy is through your job. One way to protect your future is through life insurance with SelectQuote. I think Matt mentioned this yesterday, but for me, having life insurance hanging over my head when my daughter was born was terrifying. And the beauty of this is it's once and done. But somehow getting to that once is very, very difficult for people, and it's understandable. It can be extremely intimidating. But here's a way to make it much easier. For over 40 years, SelectQuote has been one of the most trusted brokers in insurance, helping more than 2 million Americans secure over $700 billion in coverage. Their mission is simple: to find you the right insurance policy for your unique needs. They shop, you save. Unlike other one-size-fits-all insurance companies, SelectQuote's licensed agents work for you. In as little as 15 minutes, they'll compare policies from top-rated carriers to find you the best fit for you. And they work for you for free. Head to SelectQuote.com/majority. A licensed insurance agent will call you right away with the right policy for your life and budget. No medical exam, no problem. They partner with providers offering same-day coverage up to $2 million without needing to visit your doctor. Have high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease? SelectQuote has partners with policies designed for many pre-existing health conditions so you get the protection you deserve. Life insurance is never cheaper than it is today. SelectQuote, they shop, you save. The point being, as you get older, life insurance gets more expensive. So now is the time to do it. Check out whole life insurance, term life insurance. They'll explain to you the difference. Google and see what's, do some research, find out what's best for you. But it's a great, straightforward way to make sure you're getting the best deal from legitimate carriers. Get the right life insurance for you for less and save more than 50% at SelectQuote.com/majority. Save more than 50% on term life insurance at SelectQuote.com/majority today to get started. That's SelectQuote.com/majority. I don't give financial advice, but I got term life insurance. That's so I do it, for a certain period of time till my kids are out of college when they were young. So check it out. We will put a link in the podcast and YouTube descriptions and quick break. When we come back, David Dayen, executive editor of the American Prospect and co-host of the Organized Money Podcast. Right back. We are back, Sam Cedar and David Dayen. I should say Emma Vigeland is out today, still a little bit under the weather. Welcome back to the program. David Dayen, executive editor of the American Prospect, co-host of the Organized Money podcast. David, welcome to the show. There's going to be, almost guaranteed a shutdown of DHS, 240,000 some odd employees. Let's just start. Like, what is your understanding? What will happen to ICE? ICE is the only thing that's going to function, it seems like, out of the DHS after this.
Yeah. So we're going to be reporting today that Democrats actually made an offer to Republicans to cleave off ICE and CBP. And fund the rest of DHS, and Republicans said no. So Republicans are going to come out today and say, Democrats are shutting down TSA, they're shutting down the Coast Guard, they're shutting down FEMA. In fact, Democrats had offered to fund all of that because their core issue is with how ICE is functioning and how the Customs and Border Patrol are functioning. So yes, you are correct that because of the Big Beautiful Bill, which gave $75 billion to ICE and something like $65 billion to CBP, those agencies will continue to function despite DHS being shut down. However, I think we should see this as an opportunity to go after the base funding of these agencies as long as they're funded supplementally by additional funding. That's certainly what Republicans would do, right? So when Democrats increased the budget for the IRS, what did Republicans immediately do? They went after the base funding of IRS so that that funding was not supplemental, but a replacement for the base funding. And I see no compelling reason to fund ICE in the next 3 years. They have, like you just said, they have all the money they need. So we should, Democrats, in my view, should say, okay, well, this base funding doesn't need to exist anymore as long as you got $75 billion, which is 7.5 times the annual budget of ICE. As long as you have that, okay, just we won't fund ICE anymore. So I see this as a prelude to that.
How does the appropriation of that extra bump, like, was that a one time we're just putting into your ledger or your checking account essentially, and so that money's already there. So they're going to be able to continue on with their operations because they're using that essentially their slush fund as opposed to the operating budget. Okay. That seems like a very obvious thing to basically say, like, we're not going to shut. We don't have the ability to shut down ICE. But why do they need this extra money? They're not showing. There's no.
I mean, it makes all the much more sense when you recognize that Tom Homan has taken ICE out of Minnesota, or claims he will be anyway, and that they are moving ICE to a targeted operations mode. This is their claim. I don't know that it's true or not, but this is their claim, right? We're just going to targeted operations. We're not doing these roving patrols. We're not doing stop and grab anymore. Well, what do you need all that money for? I mean, the whole point of the surge was because you were doing expanded operations. If you're not expanding the operations, sounds like you don't need that money. So one way to claw it back is by just defunding the base budget.
Well, have the Democrats been, how public have the Democrats been with the offer that they made to fund all of DHS but for ICE and CBP?
It's going to be public in about 2.5 hours when we report it.
With all due respect to you, why didn't they come out and announce this? It sounds like you, like, why aren't they doing any politics around this?
I think obviously this is going to come out. And, the list of demands that we've seen are all about reform. You know, there has been no demand to claw back that money from last July.
Right.
But I think there's a way in which we're kind of backdooring into that by not funding the base budget. And as long as those, you know, there's an impasse there, I don't realistically think there's going to be an impasse for 3 years, but there's a compelling case for there to be an impasse for 3 years on the ICE budget and on the Customs and Border Patrol budget.
Democrats could just at this point come out and say, we're willing to fund all of DHS, but there's been no need for additional funding for ICE. And it's that simple of a message.
Right. And essentially, they did that back channel to the Republicans. They said, we'll fund the rest of the DHS budget. And when this comes out, fortunately, nobody listens to your show. So we're going to break
this news in the prospect. We're not scooping you. We're not scooping you. People can, I would suggest, because Chuck Schumer and Jeffries don't seem to want to go out and tell people that this is the offer they've made, which seems to me to be absolutely bizarre. I would imagine, like, this is what I would have been coming out with at the beginning of the week and going on whatever it is that they go on, Morning Joe or the weekend shows or whatnot.
I mean, it's kind of an extension of what they did 2 weeks ago, because 2 weeks ago there were six funding bills that were outstanding, right? And they said, we'll pass five of them. We're just not going to pass DHS. We want to negotiate on that. And eventually Republicans caved and said, okay, we will pass those other five bills and we will negotiate on DHS. Now you can see the circle tightening even more. Okay, we'll pass all of DHS except for the ICE budget and the CBP budget. And Republicans initially balked at not passing the five bills without DHS. And I feel like you could get them to eventually agree to pass the rest of DHS without ICE and CBP.
Well, they would rather do that than say any of this money is contingent upon, let's say, no masks or whatever, right? Or a willingness to abide by the Constitution when it comes to judicial warrants.
But right. They've said those are non-starters. I mean, Republicans have come out and said, we are not going to do that. And so at this point, I think Democrats are justified to say, okay, fine. And you can deal with the $75 billion that you got last July.
It's so frustrating. And I know, obviously, I'm howling at the moon here. But it feels like the Democratic leadership could come out and say, the Republicans agreed that that ICE should not be wearing masks, and they've reversed themselves, and just make Republicans say, we have not. No, we're in favor of masks, because right. It is such a, like, this is not even like a 70-30 type of thing. This feels like a 90-10 thing, particularly right. After all the Second Amendment stuff. And they just are not. It continues to shock me how little politics the Democrats feel like they need to do for the fall.
Well, and yet, in spite of that, I mean, I think they have gotten on the right side of this issue, right? I mean, they are in a place where they've put Republicans up against the wall, forcing them to have to, first of all, back off of the aggressive enforcement. I saw a story today about how Republicans think backing out of Minnesota is going to help them in the elections, right? So now that's kind of the way they're thinking, yep, is that we can't do this anymore, number one. And number two, agreeing with the basic premise that the way things were going, whether in Minneapolis or elsewhere, needs to be changed. So Democrats got that far. Now I think they're backing into what I think is the other correct, circumstance here, which is just defund ICE.
Yep.
just claw back the base funding, because they already have enough money to last them 7 years.
I guess I want to see more aggressiveness. I'm of the school of, like, when your opponent is injured, it's a great time to injure them more. But I mean, that's just my, that's the way I work. But speaking of which, I mean, with that said,
that's why you were banned from the National Football League, that, because of that mentality.
There was one or two times where I had problems at school, high school, but nevertheless, let's talk Epstein. There's a lot of fallout from Epstein. I know you guys are working on a bunch of big stories that you can't talk about won't even say to me.
I gave you one scoop. I can't give you another.
No, I understand. Today, Barack Obama's former White House lawyer and now the chief lawyer of Goldman Sachs, she had to resign. It is... it's sort of fascinating. I mean, I guess we've seen it across the board, but none of the hardcore Republicans associated with this seem to have resigned. It seems to be, and I think everybody should. I would like to have all these people excommunicated from society. But it's interesting to watch the dynamic where, for the most part, not across the board, to the extent that there's any accountability, it's happening not with some of the most prominent players.
I mean, that's more pronounced if you go outside of America, right? So there's this kind of shame meter. And the shame meter in Norway or England is more towards the side of actually having some. And then you get to the Democratic elite, and there's less ability to have shame, but maybe some existing vestigial sense of shame, and that's what we see in Rumler. And then you get the Republicans, there's no shame at all. And so Howard Lutnick is still the Commerce Secretary, for example.
It's really impressive how Lutnick has been able to maintain. We should also say, though, I mean, to fair, Larry Summers seems to be, for the most part, off the scene, as it were. Nobody who has lauded this guy or promoted this guy, I mean, this is someone who's probably one of the most significant players in Democratic economic policy for a couple of decades. Nobody who has been propping this guy up in many respects seems to have paid, have even had a word to say about it. I mean, this guy was sitting on Project 2029 for the Democrats up until moments before this. And it's shocking.
Yeah, I mean, I think I wrote sort of last summer when this was really bubbling up that the Epstein scandal is a policy issue, and people aren't looking at it that way. It just looks like a window into how elites talk to each other when they think nobody's listening. But the policy issue is elite impunity. That's the policy issue that has really engulfed this country for the last 25 years, if not longer. The fact that nobody went to jail for torture under the Bush administration or lying the country into war, the fact that nobody went to jail for the financial crisis and the mass unemployment and 10 million foreclosures that engendered, built upon a mountain of fraud. All of these things have sapped faith in institutions to a level that is really debilitating for progressive politics. On our next episode of Organized Money, we actually have Ro Khanna on. He wrote the Epstein Files Transparency Act that is the reason we're seeing all these emails right now. And it was really fascinating. He talked about how his politics almost have changed because of his association with this piece of legislation. That he recognizes now that accountability actually has to come first before policy. He was kind of a policy wonk and someone who, you know, he really was more comfortable talking about, you know, what we need to do in rural America or you know, this policy or that policy. But he realizes now that accountability actually is what gets you the buy-in to go forward with an activist government. And what we're seeing right now is only a part of that accountability. You know, what we're talking about, getting people to step down, it's kind of like a neoliberal version of accountability. We hope the market will discipline these people right into shame. But that's not real accountability. It's transparency, which is certainly part of it. But it's until we have the courage to use justice dispassionately and be willing to follow evidence where it leads and take action, then we're not going to have that accountability. And I think, you know, the way that Democrats are starting to talk about this, the fact that, you know, many of them agreed to issue a subpoena to Bill Clinton, for example, it shows that they're understanding that this accountability issue, which I described literally 10 years ago in my book, Chain of Title, as a rot at the heart of our democracy, is much more important than they had expected.
Yeah, that type of like literal, almost material accountability is the scaffolding for all of the rhetoric and all the sort of cultural and the shaming and whatnot. And all of that stuff falls. It crumbles and it actually, I think, cuts the other way without the actual material accountability. It feels like we've got a lot more of that coming. I also want to, you wrote this week, I think, with Ryan Grimm about a couple of candidates in Illinois getting sort of not quite AIPAC funding, but sort of like, or I guess maybe sort of laundered.
Well, one of them's direct now. So they're actually, I did two pieces on this, one with Ryan and one individually. And the one with Ryan, yes, talks about two ways in which AIPAC, without endorsing candidates or without using its designated super PAC, which is called United Democracy Fund, is finding ways to support and influence elections in favor of their preferred candidates. They're doing this in a couple different ways. One is by using super PACs with very neutral sounding names like Elect Chicago Women or Affordability Chicago Now.
Didn't like Andrew Cuomo run on the like New York Women for Women line? I think 1 year he did or something.
Yeah. So they're using these super PACs to deliver support. There are three candidates. One is Melissa Bean in the 8th District of Illinois, where Roger Krishnamoorthy is running for U.S. Senate. So these are all open seats, all three of these, actually. So Melissa Bean, she used to be a member of Congress. She was a banker. She was the head of the New Dems. She's really a nightmare. She's getting support from Elect Chicago Women. Laura Fine in the 9th District, where Jan Schakowsky used to be the congresswoman, she's stepping down. She's getting this support. She's a state senator, also from Elect Chicago Women. And then this woman, Donna Miller, this is the most interesting case to me. She is a Cook County commissioner. She's running in the South Side, 2nd District of Illinois. Now I'm not remembering. There's so many of these open seat races. But, oh, yeah, Robin Kelly. He's also running for U.S. Senate. She actually had very little money in the bank. She wasn't really gaining a whole lot of traction. It's a very crowded field. And he ends up fundraising $1 million in the fourth quarter of 2025. And all of a sudden, there's a super PAC, Affordable Chicago Now, that is supporting her with millions of dollars of ads. And subsequent research, this is the second way now that AIPAC is supporting these candidates. Subsequent research showed that about 83 to 84% of Miller's donors had previously donated to AIPAC. All those fourth quarter 2025 donors, out of the $1 million+, something like 850,000 came from former AIPAC donors. And those
that's
donors.
That's stunning. That's quite an email list that somebody has.
Well, and you see it even more so with the fact that 65 of those donors also donated to Laura Fine, and 230 of those donors also donated to Melissa Bean. So there's a coordination that's going on where AIPAC is sending emails, setting up unlisted fundraising websites where you can donate to one and the other. Many of these donors were giving the same amount of money to different candidates on the same day. You can see that in the campaign finance data. So AIPAC sets up these websites or emails their donor list and says, hey, go directly support. So normally this would be like AIPAC bundling money to give to these candidates. But the way that they're doing it, they are basically saying, you go give money to these candidates, and unless you dig through the campaign finance data, you don't notice the pattern.
The associations whatsoever. And who even pointed them in that direction?
Correct. You can't even find them. They're unlisted campaign websites that is coordinating all these efforts. So those are three. And then a few days later, I found there's a fourth. So there's a race in the... God, now I'm forgetting all the numbers. It's like the 7th district, I think. This is the west side of Chicago. Danny Davis was the congressman. He's stepping down. And this candidate, Melissa Conyers Irvin, is actually getting direct support from United Democracy Project, which is AIPAC's super PAC. And she's getting $2.8 million in support. And she was previously... kind of an also ran in the campaign fundraising race. She only has a few hundred thousand dollars in the bank. So this is a massive amount of support. And you see it, you know, in a city like Chicago, where it takes a lot of money to get notice, these super PAC ads are very, very useful to break out of the pack because a lot of the other candidates can't afford to put ads on the air at all.
Particularly when you have half a dozen, eight.
In some cases, eight, 10, 12 candidates for the primary. And by the way, this primary is in March. This is why we're learning about Illinois first, because Illinois is one of the first states to have its primary. The primary is March 17th.
And there's no analysis as to... the functional equivalent would be if on the majority report we said, hey, go support this candidate. Go directly to their website. There'd be no, unless you knew that, somebody was paying attention to what the Majority Report was doing, you wouldn't know that's where those 50 donations came from. But I'm curious.
And I want to be clear, there's nothing illegal.
There's
about
nothing
that,
illegal
right?
about this.
I mean,
but I'm curious about
any candidate you want.
Of course. But, it's helpful to know if 50 donations are coming via the Majority Report, it gives you a sense of what the politics are that are supporting that candidate.
There are progressive organizations that do this, like the Progressive Change Campaign Committee does this, but they do it in public. And they say, we're putting up a public fundraising website because we want the candidates to know.
Oh, that we take credit from. Yes, from there's that. Another way to do it is where go to the Majority Report Act Blue page and that money will go there. But here's the other question is that, do we have a sense of those, whatever that pool of donors are that AIPAC can basically say, hey, go donate here, go donate there, and they do it, one-to-one conversion rate. Do we know who those people are insofar as, what their history of supporting candidates are? Because my guess is, at best, it's 50-50 Republican-Democrat, maybe worse.
Well, we know that there are a lot of AIPAC donors that support Republicans. In one race, the Donna Miller race, we know that she received, of that $1 million, raised in the fourth quarter of last year, about 40,000, I believe, came from Trump donors, like people who donated to Donald Trump. And that's true to a smaller degree for Melissa Bean and Laura Fine. So there's a lot of cross-pollination there. There's no question. And, J.P. Pritzker came out today in an article on Mother Jones and said that AIPAC is now an adjunct of the Republican Party. And yet they continue to play in these primaries on the Democratic side. And they're not even the biggest.
Where's the Democratic Party campaigns in this? Like, after Malinowski made that proclamation after he lost in New Jersey 11th right. to a progressive Mejia candidate, where is the Democratic Party in basically, because they have the capacity, if not, they can't say, they can't outlaw AIPAC, but they can really discourage money from playing, you know, entering in and punish, you know, candidates who receive that money and take it. Where's the Democratic Party in this?
Well, let me talk about two things. I will get to that. But first, you know, one thing we should say is that AIPAC learned from what was a total colossal mistake in the New Jersey race, right? Yeah. They go out and attack Tom Malinowski, basically because he wouldn't bend the knee to say unconditional support for Israel. He left open the idea. This is a guy that AIPAC supported in the past, Malinowski, when he was in Congress. They said, you know, we're going to make a lesson of you. Like, you have to toe the line completely, and if you don't, we're going to attack you. And by attacking him, they left open the ability for Ana Lilia Mejia to win the race, and she did. And so the spots that we're talking about in these Chicago area races are all positive. They are not attacking some other candidate. They are all, you know, biographical, positive spots about Melissa Bean, Donna Miller, Laura Fine, Melissa Conyers Irvin. So there was a lesson learned there, I feel like, that, okay, we're not going to sort of attack people for having, you know, diminished loyalty. We're going to uplift in these open seat races and try to cut through the clutter by raising them up. Now, as far as what the Democratic Party can do, it's a bigger story than AIPAC, right? So in that same race where Donna Miller is getting all this AIPAC money, the other AIPAC, which is AIPAC money, right? For money from the artificial intelligence industry, right, is supporting a different candidate, supporting Jesse Jackson Jr., who is trying to get back to Congress after he was put in jail for corruption. And the AIPAC that is called Leading the Future actually has more money in its war chest than AIPAC does. It has 125 million, whereas AIPAC has about 95 million. And a separate PAC for crypto, which we saw try to buy the 2024 elections, has $190 million.
And we should say they got rid of Sherrod Brown in Ohio. Mm-hmm. There was a couple other races where they were quite successful in.
Right. But they're sort of biding their time because there's active legislation in Congress right now, and they want to see who's going to pass it and who's not. And whoever defies them there, they'll probably throw a bunch of money against those guys. So this is a cancer. I mean, this is the real issue in Democratic politics right now, as I see it. There's a lot of talk about, you know, the soul of the party and whether they should go to abundance or whether they should go towards populism. But the real story is that there are hundreds of millions of dollars being put forward to elect candidates. And the question is, why are these candidates accepting it? And there's a real cross pattern between people who have shown the tendency or capacity for corruption in other forms and people who are all too willing to take this money. And so it goes actually back to the Epstein thing. If you're willing to be personally corrupt, then big money and elites are going to be able to buy you much more easily. And this ultimately, the fact that this is indulged within the Democratic Party is a big part of the problem.
I read the other day that Schumer was really pushing hard to get this crypto legislation, I guess, buttoned up on some level. It permeates. I mean, the crypto money in particular.
He did this in 2004, right? He went on a conference call and said that we're, you know, Democrats are the crypto fans, and we want this industry to thrive.
Amazing timing. Like, we're 18 months out from essentially the crypto market. Everybody turning around, going like, what was this for again? Like right. These are the I can see even the like finance guys on Instagram are like, the use case of crypto really seems to have fallen apart at this point.
The bottom line is that this level of money that, you know, we've always seen special interests play in elections, but not with these kinds of numbers in primary races where they're, you know, the battle for the soul of the party. We have all these discussions about it, but it's happening because massive sums of money are being thrown at people to you know, toe the line on their particular issues. And until the party adopts some way to do something about this. Now, there have been ideas that in party primaries, maybe you can discourage or maybe even limit the use of super PAC money as a condition of being the endorsed candidate of the party. I don't know exactly how viable that is. I know it was a subject for discussion at the Democratic National Committee. Larry Cohen, who was a Bernie Sanders fan, former head of the Communications Workers of America, this is a real crusade for him and Sanders as well. Something needs to be done. And until you know, maybe the Mejia race is an example that, you know, she was outspent by massive amounts of money, and she ends up winning the race. The guy down in Texas who won the state Senate race was outspent 10-1,
yep,
still won the race. So you know, maybe there's diminishing returns to this money. Maybe the fact that people watch less and less television, more and more are online and streaming, maybe that changes the game. But we overrate these ideological debates as a factor, and we underrate the massive power of big money as a factor.
Although that money, obviously, in many ways, one is the vapor form and one is the solid form of the same argument in many respects.
I agree. There's cross-pollination there, but ultimately it's the money that's winning out, and we got to do something about it.
Just kudos on the reporting, because this stuff can't be, there can't be diminishing returns for that money if people aren't aware of where it comes from. And that's why it's so important about the reporting you guys are doing.
I appreciate that. And if you want to be hopeful about this, it's the fact that AIPAC realizes they have to be sneaky about this.
Right.
They have to conceal their preferences, because obviously, after the genocide in Gaza and after all of these, the severe change in public opinion around the Israeli government and the entire situation, they realize that they're a toxic brand. And if this is publicized to a greater degree, that money will start to look kind of like Elon Musk's money looks in these political races.
And people should remember Wisconsin in April of last year, mm-hmm. I guess it was now,
right.
In terms of Elon Musk money, although he's putting a lot more back in these races, but that's for another day. All right. Lastly, I want to talk about antitrust. I want to talk about the sports that you are covering, like sort of all the facets of how sports have become worse. because of largely around antitrust issues, this coming on when the chief antitrust lawyer from the DOJ has been ousted, as like Trump's about to go on a merger spree or signing off on mm-hmm. on a bunch of mergers ranging from like Nexstar to there's Ticketmaster stuff. Tell us about the nexus of all that. Well.
Yeah. Right. Well, we'll separate the two out. So, yes, Gail Slater was the assistant attorney general for antitrust at the Justice Department. When she came in, there was this thinking that she was a little aligned with the more aggressive antitrust posture that was taken by people like Lina Khan and Jonathan Cantor. She quickly realized that actually what rules Washington at this moment is lobbyist money. And in particular, Mike Davis, who is with the Article 3 Project, and he's a big MAGA guy, he's taken millions of dollars from companies who want to get their antitrust problems resolved. And it's not just Mike Davis, Kellyanne Conway, and a guy named Arthur Schwartz is a little more low profile. These guys have appealed to Pam Bondi and her office and had them overrule the antitrust division in a number of cases, whether to green light mergers or to stop monopolization cases from going forward. And the next one that's coming down the pike is Ticketmaster, where in 2024, the Biden administration's antitrust division of the Justice Department filed a case to break up Ticketmaster and Live Nation, which controls event ticketing, venues, artist promotion, and even artist management, and uses that in kind of a flywheel effect where one enables them leverage over the other to create this huge unaccountable monopoly in entertainment. And they hired Mike Davis. They hired Kellyanne Conway. They put Rick Grinnell, who's running the Kennedy Center and is also like an envoy to some national security stuff in the Trump administration. They put him on the Live Nation board. He's on the board of Live Nation now. And they basically said, look, we want this case dropped. We want it settled. Well, you know, Ticketmaster will give some piddling fine and they'll move on to continue to monopolize live entertainment. And the prelude to this is getting Slater to resign. So functionally, there is no antitrust division at the Justice Department anymore. There is only Pam Bondi and Todd Blanche and what the lobbyists tell them to do, because they're just a bunch of sock puppets. That's what's going on now. And J.D. Vance was, Gail Slater was his staffer. And allegedly, he was going to be sort of the protection for Gail Slater. And it turns out he's just a coward in the face of money and
what,
power.
Wait,
and
what?
That wasn't, didn't happen at all.
Wait, yes. What?
Yes.
I
exactly.
Are you telling me that J.D. Vance's populist and antitrust posturing was just a ruse?
I'm sad to break this news to you. I don't want to be the one who crushes your dreams and hopes of a bipartisan attack.
But MAGA,
against,
populism. I mean.
Right. I know. I feel bad having to be the one to say this to you, but I'm sad to say that is.
Wow, that is shocking. But at least he put up the good fight and lasted 13 months, right? Or I guess 11 or 12
not even
months.
Really? I don't want to. I don't want to uplift Gail Slater as sort of the last bastion against all of this. In her 13 months, the Justice Department Antitrust Division didn't bring a single monopolization case. They didn't bring a single merger challenge. She basically thought, like, okay, if I am still here and I sort of meekly disagree with this pay-to-play corruption, then I can justify my job. But she had no intention of leaving until she was basically told, "You're either going to be fired or you resign." And then she resigned. That was how this went down.
Why would you do that? Why would you resign instead of getting fired?
Well, because now she can go back and say, look, I had principles and I wasn't, you know, someone who just sat there and was willing to take it. And so she stepped down. Maybe now there'll be some narrative that Gail Slater, the bold person inside the Trump administration who bravely quit rather than do the bidding of lobbyists. But it's all bullshit.
Right.
She was totally ready to do that bidding with sort of mild opprobrium until she was told she wasn't allowed to do that anymore.
That's why I don't understand. I mean, this is neither here nor there. I don't understand the logic. Why wouldn't you resign so that you could show that you were at loggerheads with them? Like, anybody
she
could have
resigned 6 months ago when they settled her one merger challenge. They went over the heads of the antitrust division and settled. It was Hewlett-Packard Enterprise and Juniper Networks. And actually, we're going to have a proceeding. We're going to have a hearing before a federal judge on that merger settlement where Mike Davis and Arthur Schwartz and some other people at the Justice Department are going to be deposed by state attorneys general, and we're going to hear about all of this. All of this rot is going to come out.
That's the last sort of like bastion is the state attorney generals who these companies, they have a claim because they, a lot of them have antitrust laws on their state books. How much is it possible? Can a judge say, you know what, based upon this action brought by the attorney general from California or from Massachusetts or New York, wherever it is, Kansas for that matter. Well, not Kansas, but we're going to revert. We're not going to accept this this deal. I mean, can a judge?
Yes. And that's, in fact, exactly what's at issue in the Hewlett-Packard Juniper case. It's a law called the Tunney Act. And the Tunney Act says that a federal judge can look at a settlement that was made in a case and decide whether or not it was in the public interest. And the state attorneys general are saying, actually, this was not in the public interest. This was done because lobbyists wanted it to be done. And the judge can look at that evidence, let those people who are at the heart of this be deposed, and then decide, no, this was not in the public interest, and I'm not allowing this settlement to go through. And so, and in addition, state attorneys general have the ability to sue under the Sherman Act, under the Clayton Act, and 40 states joined the Justice Department on the Ticketmaster case. And I have every belief that at least some of them will stay on that case and that we will have a trial in that case, which was supposed to be, it's supposed to start at the beginning of March, actually. So that's probably still going to happen, but they're going to have fewer resources, obviously, if they don't have the federal government involved. And the fact that the federal government settled is going to be a factor probably in the judge and how they look at the case. So this obviously still is a blow. But, you know, I think we have to look at this for what it is. It's total corruption. And if Democrats get back the White House and Congress in 2029, they should move to basically nullify everything that this Justice Department Antitrust Division has done. And reverse all of these merger approvals, reverse all of these settlements in these monopolization cases, and go right back to square one.
And they should go on record now to do that so that these companies can't pretend like they didn't know come that day. All right. So let's talk about the sports issue. I'm sorry Emma's not here because she obviously is very sports oriented, but
she's the fan.
But within the context of this, like, sports wrapped up in questions of affordability, in questions of how much a municipality or a state, for that matter, should be subsidizing a private enterprise. Tell us the scope of what you're covering on this issue.
So we had a partnership on this with the Groundwork Collaborative, and all of the stories are out now. They're at prospect.org/sports. You can find every single story there. And the reason that we did it is that, you know, sports is kind of like the last thing that we all have a mass culture around in America. 93 of the top 100 television programs in terms of audience were sports in the last year. You can go into any bar in America and talk about sports and you'd probably get a real reception. There are common sort of facts that we point to. These guys won the tournament, or these guys were the Super Bowl champions. It's hard to be in dispute on that. And people understand the game, and they actually understand the economics of the game, whether it's salary caps or, you know, they understand it in the context of their teams, of their fans. And on the field, I think the reason that there's such commonality there is that on the field, the principles of competition and fairness are really paramount. We have umpires and referees that look at the game. The idea is that, you know, between the lines, if you're overconfident, you can lose to a team that works harder. All of those things are very American, we tell ourselves they're very American ideals. Off the field, we've completely migrated away from that. 20% of all billionaires own a share, at least, of a sports franchise. In this case, it's an incredible statistic. The top level of sports is dominated by the oligarchs, who are like the kings and queens of our previous eras. And the rest of us are kind of poking our way to even see inside. The prices for entry into sports arenas and stadiums has gone up precipitously, especially since the pandemic. There are now fewer seats in most stadiums because they reserve more space for luxury boxes. So there are actually more tickets on sale for Major League Baseball in 1994 than there were today, than there were last year, because of this phenomenon of smaller ballparks with more luxury seating. So we've turned sports into kind of a gated community where if you're rich and powerful, you can get in to see, and if not, you can sort of poke through the fence hole and watch. But even there, we're paying for that through streaming prices and things like that. And then, you know, many of the struggles that we see in sports are mirrors of struggles we see in other contexts, whether it's labor. A good example is the WNBA is probably going to go on strike this year. Other sports franchises, because of their collective bargaining agreements.
A fact that I saw in the piece about that, they get about 9% of their league's revenue relative to, like, all other sports, where it's closer to like 30% of the revenue.
No, it's closer to 50%.
50% of the revenue goes to the players. Because of their collective
bargaining agreements. Right. And who are the talent? Like, you don't go to a game to watch the owners. You know, there's the labor aspect. There's the aspect of, you know, in college sports, for example, where players didn't get paid at all for a long time. And now that they are, the NCAA and college administrators are appealing to Congress to try to stop the crisis of sports and that crisis in college. And that crisis is that the players are actually getting paid for their value. We have a great story in there about these. They're almost like payday loans that agents place upon young players, telling them, oh, we'll give you $2 million up front, and all you have to do is give us 10% of your income in perpetuity. And they did this to several players, including star players who, you know, signed $300 million contracts in baseball and then have to give tens of millions of dollars to this agency that gave them a little bit of money up front. They call it athlete finance, and it's a predatory lending scheme that we go into in this issue. And so, you know, a lot of the things that we see in our economy and society, runaway inequality, financialization, struggles of labor, it's all mirrored in sports in a way that I think people who aren't tuned in to these debates can actually readily understand. And so that's why we put this together.
I mean, that's what I think the utility, I mean, the stories are fascinating. Like just the one that you cited too, the sort of like venture capital for human beings on some weird way.
Yeah.
But all these stories are great things to send to your relatives. I mean, because it is an entree into understanding some of the fundamental problems that we have in our economy and the way it's structured and the exploitive nature of our economy without it seeming like you're talking about politics on some level. And that's what I appreciate about it so much. And you also have there's a great piece about the online sports betting, which has become nuts.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that one. Yeah, that's absolutely insane. And one of the things we get into that I haven't seen in other, there's been a lot of stories about gambling, is how this is dropping down into not just college, but high school and even junior high school. We talked to a principal who was like principal of the year, who says, I hear kids talking about parlay bets who are like 14 and 15 years old. And so it's obviously like this huge social epidemic that is particularly infecting like young men and young boys. And the rise of prediction markets who are trying to get out of the actual gambling, the gambling regulation. They're just sports betting that they use the fact that, you know, the technology is somewhat different to say that, oh, actually, we don't have to apply. We don't have to comply with any state gambling laws. It's absolutely insane. And it's, you know, we're starting to see some pushback. Maryland and Vermont have bills to actually end online sports gambling in their states. And I suspect we're going to see more in the years to come.
The predictive markets thing, my God, the best was that we were talking about this, I think, at the beginning of the week. Jesus, 5% chance of coming back by 2027. Did you know that?
Do you know why that is?
Yes, because we explained the derivatives market. Yeah. Yes.
There is a separate prediction market that is betting on whether the prediction market on Jesus will get to a certain number.
So in other words, what people are betting on is whether there are enough people who think that Jesus is coming back in 2027, that they will bet in that first bet that Jesus is coming back by 2027, the number will go from, because it's predictive, not an odds line, it's a prediction, that 7% of people will bet that Jesus is coming back by 2027. And you're betting on whether it will go from 5% to 7%. And then there's another derivative market that is betting on where people will predict the prediction of Jesus returning. It's so insane.
But the point is that there's no reason that the same people who are betting on whether that number will go from 5 to 7 are the people who are betting on whether Jesus is going to come back, right? So they're manipulating the first market to cash in on the second market.
The way you do that, just in case you're interested, is I will bet $10 that Jesus is going to come back by 2027, and I'm going to get a bunch of other people to bet $10. But on the secondary market, on the derivative bet, I'm going to bet $40 that it's going to go up. So I'm going to lose my $10 bet, but I'm going to win my $40 bet because I placed that $10 bet.
And that's called rank market manipulation. And these are funny, and sometimes these are really dangerous. Like, there was a whale that made money off of Maduro being captured, and there was a belief that this was a White House insider who was making money off of White House policy. And all of that is insane, and it really calls into question a whole bunch of stuff. But the reality is 90% of the bets on prediction markets are sports betting. We should keep this in perspective. These are sports gambling sites that are trying to get around regulation of gambling.
And to see guys like Maloney, Sean Maloney, who was the formal DCCC, he is now like the chief lobbyist for predictive markets, doing videos about how like this is going to help us see the future and formulate policy and blah blah blah. Like, where's the Democratic Party on the idea that there's a 5% chance that Jesus is coming in 2027? Like, how does that impact who we should choose for our nominee? Because if Jesus is back, I mean, it's going to impact, like, you don't want some out-and-out atheist to be the nominee in 2027 if Jesus comes back and then that person looks like they're an idiot, right? I mean.
But what are Jesus's views on land use? That's my real question, and zoning.
Jesus is just going to be like, let the chips fall where they may.
Anyway, so it's
this is going to be up there. We should just tell people all of these stories are evergreen. And so they are great pieces to send to your, obviously they're great to read yourself, but they have a utility that I think a lot of stories about this don't have in the same way, because it is such a universal sort of language in our society.
And we are, to be fair, we are starting to see Democrats talk a lot about this stuff. I talked to Chris DeLuzio for The Issue. I know some others are talking about surveillance pricing, for example, at stadiums and things like that.
In New York,
ticketing.
I think we're putting like there is now going to be some what do you call it notices of surveillance pricing in
Well, that's a separate thing, but yes, basically I mean, this is disclosure law, which is second order, but anytime you are on a phone, let's say, and you're making a purchase of a Target or something, if that price was derived using your personal information, there will be a disclaimer that comes up that says, warning, this price was set based on your personal data and information. And, you know, companies attempted to have that thrown out of court and they were unsuccessful. So that is true in the state of New York. That is a reality now.
And that's good stuff, because I think it's a lot of people are going to be surprised.
Good, I think we can go further.
Without a doubt. But I'm not convinced that you can go further without people understanding what's going on. And that is a great way to let people know that as an interim step. David Dayan, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to the prospect.org/sports because I do not see it, to be honest with you, up on your menu bar or your what do you call those banner?
Well, I think it says current issue, and that's where it is. But we'll change the language there for you.
Thank you, I appreciate that. I want to see a sports vertical.
Yeah, you'll get there.
All right, see that. Getting results, David. Getting Dan, results. Thanks so much for your time. There we go. I really appreciate
it. Thanks a lot.
Bye. Well, I'm going to go around to all the websites and see if it's that easy.
See if you can get a carpentry one.
Executive editor.
I got a lot of issues with the Handyman Monthly.
Tell me about it. Don't get me started on Handyman Monthly.
I really want to sit down with somebody who can show me with his derivatives, because I want to make a buttload on this whole Jesus thing.
I know.
It's a beautiful sentence. I know. That's pretty much what the starter of every mega church has said.
But I mean, but here's the thing: is that like that's when you're gonna know. Like, I'm about to ride off into the sunset, where I'm like, listen, everybody, I want you all to go place a bet that Jesus is coming 2027, and then I'm in the derivatives market and just cashing it in. We are definitely I cannot tell people how many times it's at least once a week where I'm like, how did we not capitalize on the whole accusation
that
TYT leveled against us, that Anna what's her face leveled against us, that we were advertising for Kamala Harris, because the bet was live and I 100% knew that we had not, we've never taken any money from a politician or a political group. And it was because Polymarket was, you weren't allowed to bet on it, right? But I mean, somebody must have had.
I told one of our European listeners.
My sister has friends in Europe. And I could have just like somehow like got money there and just made a killing. Does it matter? Like, do other people have to bet?
Yes,
for there to be?
That's how you all make
right,
it.
So that was the problem. Is that like there's only three people,
right.
Like for three instance, TYT Jesus. Listeners who are looking. It doesn't matter what the odds are.
I think the Jesus pot is like over 20 million now.
Really?
Yeah.
Smart thing would have been to act as if we were embarrassed by what Anna said and then place all the bets so that
are so outraged by this, we're not going to even address it at all.
It's beneath us.
It's totally.
Bye, 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 bye.
Just didn't think quick enough on this whole thing.
I still feel bad about the thing that all the money went to businesses during COVID.
Oh, PPP.
PPP loan.
Left Reckoning could have easily got some of that. I was too lazy.
Yeah.
Lazy coin. Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get free show free of commercials, but you also get the fun half, and you can IM us via the fun half or during the fun half. Also, that's jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate. No, just fair trade coffee and hot chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Mini psychologist. Maybe figure out some social media basics, like your own camera's white balance before offering unsolicited advice on optics. Love you. Left is best.
This is like a mood filter.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Listen, I have no problem with people having an issue, like preferring a different vision of the show. But understand, there isn't a pixelated version or a blurry. And when I'm out of focus, it is completely a function of my artistic vision for the show.
It's intentional, yeah.
Yes. There is a vernacular that we use here. And it is, you don't go and say to Picasso, like, whoa, why all the weird shapes? Right?
Maybe learn how to draw a human face.
Right, exactly.
Before you give unsolicited
advice.
Dude,
the face is round. What are you doing? Matt, Left Reckoning.
Left Reckoning, I have a Sunday show coming up for patrons, patreon.com/LeftReckoning. But Jacobin, new Jacobin show, we had Sasha Abramski of The Nation talking about his new book on Doge. We also talked about Mark Zuckerberg moving to Miami, and also Hassan Piker making a lot of people mad. Check that out over on the Jacobin show that was up this morning, Jacobin Meg YouTube channel.
See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Yo.
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Key.
You did it!
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon!
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop. Talking
oh,
for
wow.
a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this
7A?
Yes.
Me? Is this?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go for that
one. Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Fun half. Emma Vigeland out today. Back on Monday, as it were.
Brian had never seen the picture of Nancy Pelosi with JFK.
Wow. There you go.
I'm more shocked at how old she is.
That's the, sort of the thing about the picture, yeah. And here's a picture of her with FDR.
I thought it was going to be like a baby. I don't know if you ever saw that picture when Tyler, Creator, met Tupac.
No.
Oh, he's like a child. I was going to be like that.
Science is political. Hassan is right. Newsom would just create a slow decline to fascism. Also, all the liberals wanting to start the vote blue, no matter who, before the primary, before the midterms, they were really quiet about Zora. That this is in reference to... Hassan Piker was on with Jennifer
Welch
on, I've had it, right?
No, it was a third person show. I'm not as familiar with.
Okay. Well, nevertheless, he was asked, Gavin Newsom and J.D. Vance, who would you vote for? Hassan being in California, is A, both very familiar with Gavin Newsom, and B, in California. And he said he would vote third party. Now, I assume people are not upset about how he's going to vote personally because it's California. And as I've said many times, like, you know, the issue in a safe state, who you're going to vote for is sort of secondary. But also, and I am someone who votes for the lesser of two evils. But the idea that you would espouse the voting of the lesser of two evils in a primary, because that's where we are. Let's be clear. There is no nominee for the Democratic primary, and there is no nominee for the Republican, there's no Democratic nominee for the presidency, and there's no Republican nominee for the presidency. The idea that you would even be even remotely perturbed during essentially what we're in is the pre-primary or the primary for 2028 as to what people are saying. I mean, I would imagine when we were in 2020, saying something to the effect of like, I can't even imagine voting for Joe Biden. It is stupid. And what it does to me when people do that, I mean, obviously, yes, there's the hypocrisy about Chuck Schumer not voting for Zohran and
entire like
and Jeffries, like, you know, Joe endorsing Brown. So late. I mean, all of that. It just goes to show like they don't even believe that stuff. Yeah. But in fact, I probably believe it more than they do.
Probably Hassan does.
But the idea that you would chastise somebody during a primary for such a thing gives away the game to me. Like, I am very late to the awareness of people being... And obviously now we have stories about how people are being paid online, influencers and stuff like that. I mean, I started doing this at a time where the idea of that was absurd. There was no even mechanism for anything like that. And the so it never really occurs to me. But like I am just shocked that there is supposedly this many people motivated about who you're going to vote for in the 2028 presidential election. We're not even in the primary yet. It's a very weird reaction.
Especially in the context of the previous election and what happened, say, in Michigan.
Yes, and I will also say, like, what's clearly going on right now, to the extent that there is any competition for the Democratic establishment and the narrative about which politics work better for the country, it is quite clear who is winning, at least relative to this competition in the past. And there was a poll, this Harry Emden clip that was going around. The number of voters who have said that the Democratic Party is too liberal is 10% higher now than it was, I think, like, 2024 or in the past 2 years or something. Now, in my mind, yeah, but I scroll through to where it was. 99, is that the... I keep going. Okay. So right now we've seen that 42% of, I was shocked by this, of Democrats who perceive themselves as Democratic Socialists, 42% under the age of 35 do, 33% of all Democrats do, which I was shocked by.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
I would expect that to be a bigger difference in those age numbers. Yeah, the older Dems.
Keep going down. And then the argument is being made here. Okay, so in 2013, back during Obama, 48% of voters say Democrats are too liberal. In 2025, 58%. The problem is, I will tell you this right now. In 2004, if you said you were a liberal, you would be pilloried by everybody from the right, because it was considered like liberal meant communist. Like, literally, the whole word progressive came in as a word to say other than liberal. In that era, that's what it meant. And 15 years later, sometime in like 2017, 2018, if you identified as a liberal, you would not get attacked by someone on the right. Like, I had people call me on Air America saying, like, you're a liberal. And I would say, dude, I'm to the left of that. And they'd be like, what? You just admitted it. Like, literally, I was like, yes, I'm doing a radio show.
I remember this era well.
And if I said I'm a liberal in 2018 on this show, the calls I would get would not be conservatives going, you just admitted it. It would be all people from the left, mostly younger than me. A lot of people are now saying, like, I knew it. I knew it. And so the idea that, like, there's 10% extra who is saying that Democrats are too liberal, I don't think it means what it would have meant in 2013 or 1996. I think it means that there are people who are going, like, they support Zionism. They are too wishy-washy on shit.
Partner with capitalists.
They partner with capitalists. I mean, it only makes sense. I would like to see what the numbers of Democrats that associated themselves with as being Democratic Socialists in 2013 and 1996. But the point is, you're seeing polling like this because there is a concerted effort. Every day I read, there's another group out there funded by crypto money, whatever it is. Stories that Chuck Schumer is actually doing a good job recruiting Senate candidates. Really? Because it doesn't look like the Chuck Schumer picked candidate is going to win in Michigan. May not be my chosen candidate, but McMurrow wasn't picked by Schumer. In Maine, I just looked at the fundraising numbers for Janet Mills. I mean, Maine Democrats don't want Janet Mills. Plattner is probably going to win that. Knock on wood. He didn't pick Osborne. Mary Pattola, was there anybody else running for Senate in Alaska? Is there? I don't think so. Like, there's no evidence that Chuck Schumer has done anything in terms of picking a good candidate for the Senate. But they're trying to promote this notion. So I don't know. I think that, like, if you see somebody bitching about Hassan Piker's answering of a completely hypothetical question at a time where, if you believe that primaries are important, maybe you don't, in which case, I don't give a shit what you think, frankly. But if you believe that primaries are important, what difference is it what he says now? I mean, you know, it's
and I'll tell you this. I've seen politicians when they hear that Hassan is in the vicinity, and the Democrat politicians, the way they want to be on that stream, they understand this. The people that don't understand this are people that don't want Hassan to have influence. That's
yes.
It,
this is people. I mean, Hassan is a proxy for them losing another fight.
Yep.
All of those people right now were thinking Zohran is going to be hated by now. And they're all the ones talking about, like, why is the snow still there in Manhattan? Yesterday was our first day above, like, 35 degrees, I think.
It's been crazy.
37.
I swear they're using the weather machines against Zohran.
It got warmer because Zohran caved.
Yep.
Yeah. Taco Zohran.
They turned the freeze ray off.
All right. Let's get to this. Let's do this. Number one. This is a video. I've been reading a little bit about this. I don't know how the guy got onto RTE radio in Ireland. He seemed to have called in, and somebody may have smuggled in a phone or what? Because he's still in detention, right? In this country, it's an Irishman who has a valid work permit. I think he's married to an American. He has been in an ICE concentration camp for over 4 months. Some people call it a detention camp. He refers to it as a concentration camp. He's in there. The caller is Seamus Culleton. Is that who it is? Who's the host?
Yeah, that's the caller.
Okay, I don't know who the host is. But he took this call. I don't know how he got a phone in there.
The best way I could describe it is probably like a modern-day concentration camp. It's a bunch of temporary tents. There's probably room for 1,000 detainees in each tent. I believe there's like 5 tents. I've been locked in the same room now for 4.5 months. I've had barely any outside time, no fresh air, no sunshine. I could probably count on both hands the amount of times I've been outside. So just locked in this room all day, every day. We've got 2 TVs on the wall. We get 3 meals a day, very, very small meals, kid-sized meals. So everybody's hungry, everybody's tired. We've got no commissary. We've got no options to get extra food or anything like that. The conditions here are filthy. The toilets, the showers, completely nasty, very rarely cleaned. I'm in fear for my life down here, honestly, because, you know, people have been killed by the staff here, by the security staff, you know? And you just don't know what's going to happen on a day-to-day basis. You don't know if there's going to be riots. You don't know if there's going to be... You don't know what's going to happen. It's just... It's a nightmare down here.
I mean, is there competition for food, given how little you're each getting?
Oh, absolutely there is, yeah. And there's, you know, there's a little bit of the discrimination, I guess, against English speakers here. You know, the Spanish speakers definitely get a preference when it comes to the extra food, if there's any extra food left over, you know, because all the staff are kind of Hispanic and, you know, they kind of stick with their own when it comes to that kind of stuff, you know. So we'd be extremely lucky to get anything extra, you know.
This is a guy who has been in the States for more than 20 years, has a valid work permit, has no criminal record, um, he came to the U.S. in 2009, overstayed a visa waiver, then ended up marrying a U.S. citizen, applying for a lawful permanent residence. He received an exemption that allowed him to work. In other words, he's doing everything legally. Yes, he overstayed his visa, which I can tell you, I know people who have done all around the world, and it is a civil violation. You cannot tell me, like, somebody who had a speeding ticket 12 years ago deserves to be in prison. And in many respects, this is going to resonate more within our society because he's English speaking. But I mean, can you imagine, like, you're in Ireland, you're hearing about this guy being detained for overstaying a visa and living in this type of squalor, like.
I mean, I saw a clip of soccer fans asked what they think about the World Cup being here, and everyone laughs. Everyone laughs and thinks it's a joke. Of course we're not going to America to celebrate soccer.
They made movies about guys who got, like, caught with drugs in Turkey, and they'll make movies, Americans getting, like, yeah. Can you imagine, like, if this was... If that Irish guy listening on the radio show was me, and I was getting a call from an American who's in China, who was living there for 20 years but had overstayed their visa, you know, 12 years ago, and now they're in a gulag, like, can you imagine, like, what the reaction would be in this country? That China is, like, holding, somebody like that? Like, what's wrong with it? Like, literally, they made movies about this. With people who were smuggling in, you know, significant amounts of drugs. Never mind getting essentially what was a functional, like a parking ticket. Insane. Absolutely insane. So, sort of like second-order insanity, came across this. On Breaking Points, and we don't tend to cover this that much. I mean, I think, like, I can't, I'm not going to lie. Like, I don't watch show... I don't watch shows that I think are, you know, mostly aligned, at least in some level. And I don't pay too much attention to Sagar, to be honest with you. And Crystal does, I think, a fine job of arguing. But this just happened to come across my Twitter feed. And I was sort of shocked because, I mean, the right in justifying this stuff is really, really running out of space. Like, I understand why you could see full-on white nationalists justifying this. And we'll play some clips from some white nationalists in a few minutes. But this project, what we're watching, saw a Minnesota lawmaker the other day say, like, you know, DHS told her they want to deport 1 million people in this country. And of course, you know, the 20 million undocumented immigrants is an exaggeration. 100 million people. 100 million people is one third of the population here. You are on a fascistic fascism, as, you know, defined. One definition is a uber nationalism that is about purification of some form. And that's what's going on here, right? And of course, you know, you're not going to get too picky in your purification. You just want to get rid of foreigners. You want to get rid of non-white people. You may scoop up some white people, too.
There's some paperwork that points them to them.
And if you're a fascist, I can understand how you would have no problem with this. But the problem is that they're also for other conservatives who want to maintain that they're not fascist, but are still sort of subscribed to, you know, I mean, I remember when Andrew Sullivan was like, you know, this isn't really conservatism during the Bush administration. And I'm like, you might as well be speaking Latin, dude, and complain. Like, you, the conservatism that you're talking about is long dead. And any like sort of like right winger who does not subscribe to this fascism is orphaned. I can tell you that right now, but they don't want to be. And so they're desperate to grasp on to some type of justification for this. But this is insane to me. So they're talking about the clip we just played of this Irishman calling into a Irish radio station talking about how they're basically in a concentration camp. And then later, Sagar is attempting to justify this in some way. Maybe he's not trying to justify it, but this is where his mind goes. Which, okay, but listen to this.
I just, maybe this is my own psychopathology on this issue. It's maddening to me that you have, for example, they're like, children should be in school. I get to move to any country in the world with my child, and I have to demand that that nation actually pay for their public school education and allow me in? No! Imagine if I showed up any other country in the world with my daughter and I said, if you kick me out, you're denying my child an education because I just show up there illegally and decide so. That's bullshit. OK, I'm just going to say it. You do not just get to move here, but enroll your children in public school and then claim that as a good because we are paying for your child's education. While you move here, you don't speak a word of English and God knows what you're actually doing in terms of society. Sorry, I know it sounds callous. It's true. No other country in the world functions that way. And when you put it that way, it's real different, isn't it? Is that vast amounts of illegals come here with their children and then decide that us as taxpayers have to pay for their health care and for their education. Sorry, I'm not okay with that, period. I will never set that precedent.
Let me ask you this question.
Period, end of story. You have to have a system which enables it so that that does not happen.
Okay,
anymore.
Okay. Well, now, Crystal goes on to take issue with, like, why are you even raising this in this segment, which we're talking about this guy in a concentration camp, which, of course, that's the obvious thing to react to. And also, she raises the fact that, like, we don't have to speculate about this. Undocumented immigrants are a net positive in terms of dollars. But he's trying to say it is completely unfair. And it is, what was it? What did he say exactly? Like, the idea that there's any country in the world that would do this. None of them would do this. No other country in the world would do it. That's how crazy it is that we allow undocumented immigrants, children, to have a right to a free education. It is so crazy. There isn't a single other country in the world that would do this unless I go to something called the internet and Google and ask that question. Is there another single country? And just off the top, France does it. But of course, they're French.
I actually know a non-French citizen, an American, who got free health care in France having food poisoning there.
Well, let's stay on topic. We can move to healthcare as well. But France does it. But they speak French. You know how the French are. If you are an undocumented immigrant in France, your kid gets educated, like K through 8 or K through 12. And then there's one other country, England. England does that if you're an undocumented immigrant. And then there's Germany. Germany also does that. Just those three, except for also Belgium, Italy, Netherlands, Spain, and most EU countries explicitly or implicitly include all children residing there in compulsory education rights, regardless of status. Much of Canada, not all of Canada, but large swaths of it. Thailand also. And Jordan. Jordan. And you know what? Mexico. Mexico provides free public education to all children, regardless of their immigration or documentation status. Like, let's just hear how sure. I mean, because this is the thing that I find fascinating about it. Because it's like, I can't address the actual reality of what's going on here in terms of like this guy going to an immigration, to a concentration camp. I can't address the separation and the brutalizing of these people. But let me justify it, because what we as a country are doing is so outside of the norm that we have to respond in some way. But what if his adamant that he recognizes sarcastic,
maybe just my pathology,
may sound like a pathology.
Yeah.
I believe this so strongly that it may sound like a pathology to you, but no other country in the world does this except for Belgium, Italy, Netherlands, France, England, Germany, Spain, most EU countries, Jordan, Thailand, just, I didn't Google other places, Mexico. Let's just listen again to how absolutely sure he is. And he realizes on some level, I think, like his subconscious is telling him, this is a pathology. You should Google this before you actually make this statement.
You're showing your pathology in 4K.
Is that vast amounts of illegals come here with their children and then decide that us as taxpayers have to pay for their health care and for their education. Sorry, I'm not okay with that, period. I will never set that precedent.
Let me ask you this question.
Period, end of story. You have to have a system which enables it so that that does not happen anymore.
Well,
and that's fundamentally the biggest disagreement between
person,
you and I.
So
he had said it earlier about the world over and over and over again. And again, we don't have to speculate about this. The Cato Institute, where he probably has worked at the Cato Institute. A guy like that.
Yeah, I think he's Manhattan.
Cato Institute, we know that in terms of tax dollars paid in and tax dollars expended upon, undocumented immigrants are a net positive. And if you really have an issue with this, like, give them a very easy path to citizenship.
Yeah.
And if they don't want it, then you can be justified in saying, like, well, then, okay, you had the option. You want to be a part of this project? Be a part of this project.
Sugar had to have Glenn Greenwald come on because he won't take this from anybody else, apparently, even though Crystal Ball says some of the same things. But last year he had to have Greenwald on because he said something about the hairdresser that was deported to El Salvador and basically said, like, what do I care about one hairdresser? And that the situation is so dire that we can't do due process anymore. So they had to get Glenn Greenwald to come in and hold his hand. And he did the exact same thing about, okay, fine, but I'm so frustrated with how much immigrants are burdening me. Go fuck yourself.
Carly Chirk says Cuba and Venezuela probably offer free education to children. I would imagine. I just think after the first 12 or 14 countries, right, I stopped Googling. But I mean, I just don't understand how someone could be so assured of this, so adamant that when you are faced with something like, again, if we got a phone call from an American citizen in China being held in a gulag because they had a civil infraction 12 years ago, but had been, legal up to that point, we would be like, this is a perfect example of like the oppressive regime there. If your response to that happening in this country is, I am so aggrieved by this dynamic, this singular dynamic, undocumented immigrants, kids getting free education. If that is so compelling to you, how do you not even do the most basic search on your premise that no other country in the world would do this? The vast majority of countries who are not nearly as wealthy as us do it. They all do it.
He was a Hudson Institute. Also, there's a debate exchange in 1980 between H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan on exactly this thing. And H.W. Bush is like, yeah, I don't want a whole bunch of uneducated 6- and 8-year-olds in our communities.
Of course. Yeah. Of course. I mean, even from the most sort of anti-immigrant perspective, educate these kids so that if you send them back to wherever they came from, they will have a future there and won't have to come back and taint your beautiful purity of your country.
Yeah. Sagar's parents are immigrants. It's disgusting.
What is the basis for what we're seeing today? This notion of, I mean, look, I understand why the conservative mind reacts to aggrievement, because that is like fundamentally what the conservative mind is. They're constantly searching for an aggrievement. There was a great piece in the New York Times that, like, now that there's no border issues in Texas, they are becoming they're ramped up their Islamophobia, because they need to feel like they are under threat and that there is some fundamental unfairness that is taking place. In this instance, for Sagar, it was, you know, that we're the only country in the world that educates undocumented immigrants' kids, which, of course, is, again, anybody can spend 5 minutes on the internet and find out that's not even remotely the case. The vast majority of EU countries do the same. Mexico does the same. Thailand, Jordan, etc. So you have to dig lower as to, like, what is generating the need to backfill with some aggrievement. And it really is embodied in this guy. His name is Jeremy Carl, and he is been nominated. He's of Montana. He's the Assistant Secretary of State for International. He's being nominated to be the Assistant Secretary of State for International Organizations. And he is, this seems to be a Senate, you need a Senate confirmation. So he's going through a Senate hearing. And the guy, Jeremy Carl, has been, in his writing and in podcast appearances and wherever it is. He's from the Claremont Institute, which is a...
Oh, yeah. It's a white supremacist think tank.
Yes. And he worked at the Hoover Institution. And went to Yale, Kennedy School of Government, et cetera, et cetera. He was a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute's Center for the American Way of Life. And here he is being asked about all of his sort of like white supremacist stuff. And he's not going to back down from that, folks.
Tell me how you define white identity and what you think is being erased about white identity.
Certain types of Anglo-derived culture that comes from our history.
There's, like what?
Let me think about this. You know, Senator...
Pause it for a second. You know what's sort of amazing about this? That he's got to think about it, because I maybe he didn't think he was going to be asked the question directly. He wrote a book called The Unprotected Class: How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. He had in 2020 and 2025 was all over, through the years, just espousing white supremacy. Good.
Book by one of your former Senate colleagues, Born Fighting, about the sort of Scotch-Irish... You know, Senator, I would say if you were to look at the book by one of your former Senate colleagues, Born Fighting, about the sort of Scotch-Irish military culture and certain, you know, pride that went with that, that would be one example.
Well, pause it for a second. Now, I got news for you. The Scotch-Irish, at the founding of this country, when we had founding fathers, they came out and fought in the Revolutionary War. And they were great fighters.
So did some free black people.
But it turns out when they didn't want to pay their taxes in the late 90s in the so-called Whiskey Rebellion, George Washington, one of the founding fathers, actually decimated them.
I wonder why it's about the Scots-Irish way of war and not the white way of war.
Because, well, like, the biggest, probably, attacks on Scots-Irish was done by George Washington.
One example. Obviously, you could have sub-elements of that culture. You could have Italians. You could have Irish. And those are in many ways more
distinct. You're worried about white culture. You're not worried about...
Oh, well, pause it. Wait. Go back. Wait. Now, there were subcultures of white? Because I got news for you. When Italians first came to this country, when the Irish first came to this country, they were not considered white. They weren't. So, like, do we... Is he saying that their culture melted into, like, that the American culture... Like, I'm trying to understand this. They're subcultures.
Yeah. The problem is whiteness is a big lie told by powerful people subscribed to by losers.
Good.
Elements of that culture. You could have Italians, you could have Irish, and those are in many ways more.
Yeah, but you're worried about white culture. You're not worried about you're now retreating to ethnic identity. You don't speak about ethnic identity. You speak about white identity. So tell me the values that stitch together white identity and that make it different than black identity.
I would say that the white church is very different than the black church in terms of its tone and style on average.
Wait a second. Is the black church threatening the white church?
With erasure? I think it's just people like me not going to church anymore.
But is
black
this,
people didn't intimidate me out of it.
Is this black church thing new?
They're taking all the church.
Like, what is he saying? Like the big difference between white culture and black culture is that the churches have different types of services. Like, I mean, I don't know. I haven't spent a lot of time in churches. I'm not going to lie. I don't know if is a Catholic service similar to like a Pentecostal service. Like, are the mega churches the same as like going to the cathedral up the road?
I went to a Protestant mass with a girl in college, and it did not look a lot like the Catholic masses that I went to growing up. No.
Sergeant Flux tells me Italians weren't considered white in the U.S. until the 1970s.
Also, one difference between the black and white churches,
the U.S. Census,
is that the black churches opposed slavery, and the white churches, for instance, the Southern Baptist Church, started calling themselves Southern Baptist because they supported slavery.
Okay.
The white church is very different than the black church in terms of its tone and style on average. Foodways could often be different.
Foodways, he sounds like
foodways?
He sounds like an academic. Like,
what is white food? What is the white food? Hamburger? Wait, that's is hamburger?
I guess it'd be burgers and bratwurst if you go to the German.
And so he's complaining that there's too many different styles of food now.
Our foodways,
like Chipotle, is taking over.
I love a white nationalist saying foodways, like a sociologist.
In foodways, we are losing our white culture.
We are losing our white spaces.
It's so hard. Hey, you know what? You know what's making it harder to get steaks these days from like white countries? The Trump administration's trade policies.
Yeah.
And those are great.
Go back. Foodways could often be different.
And those music, are being erased. Music could be different. And those are being erased.
Music could be different. Well, if you look at the Super Bowl halftime show, which was not in English this year.
So our
music's being erased because we're getting all like Spanish-sized music because of the Super Bowl.
When a white person listens to Bad Bunny, are they erasing white culture?
I want to know what white music that we listen to is not a function of black culture.
Right.
What, like, which one? You know,
Kid Rock the rapper?
The rapper! Is that white music? Is that white music? Oh my God. Not only did we have non-white heritage at the halftime in the Super Bowl, we had non-white heritage at TPUSA. They've infiltrated everywhere.
Oh my God, I didn't even think of that.
That's amazing. Which was not in English this year. That's amazing.
Should have had Ben Shapiro play violin or something.
Could be differently if you look at the Super Bowl halftime show, which was not in English this year.
So our ability to access white churches or white food or white music is being erased.
I am concerned with the majority common American culture that we had for some time that through particularly mass immigration, I think has become much more Balkanized. And I think that weakens us. And again,
pause
I'm not
so,
running
so
away
wait,
from-
wait. So the majority common white culture we had, and is he talking about, like, I'm trying to think, like, was it Balkanized because of mass immigration, or was it Balkanized because we gave black people the right to vote, let's say?
Yeah, like, was this...
I'm confused about that.
Was the antebellum South Balkanized when, you know, like 40 to, in some states, over half of the people in those states were black?
And so is the problem with the immigration just Spanish-speaking people as opposed to, like, English-speaking ones?
Yeah.
It's hard to say.
It's not letting us appreciate Ty Cobb anymore.
Comment. I'm not apologizing for
it. Well, I'm way over my time. I think you're
particularly mass immigration, I think, has become much more Balkanized, and I think that weakens us. And again, I'm not running away from that comment. I'm not apologizing for it.
Well, I'm way over my time. I think you're struggling to answer this question, right? Because underlying your beliefs is a sentiment that white culture is just simply better.
I wonder how it weakens us. Like, I wonder how that weakens us manifests it. Like, where is it manifesting? I get the idea that a Balkanized country theoretically is weaker, but I'm not sure in what context he's talking about.
The truth is America is more diverse than a large number of, say, European countries or any countries around the world. And I think that actually is better for us. That's the case.
I mean, we've been more diverse throughout the past 150, 200 years. And we seem to do pretty good during that time. I don't know what the metric is that he's using. Is there another clip of this guy?
Yeah. Another one from Chris Murphy here.
A year ago, were white Americans the most discriminated against group in the United States? You said it. So
yeah.
Senator,
certainly this is my belief. I'm not running away from that. I think that while, of course, all races in different contexts can be subject to really severe discrimination, that when we look at our legal structures, white Americans are often very disfavored in overt ways. We're seeing this in the Small Business Administration, many other places.
So your belief is that white Americans face more discrimination, at least prior to the Trump administration fixing this, than black Americans?
On average, Senator, yes, that's correct, and I'm not running away from that statement at all.
Hmm.
Not running away from the dumb shit he's saying. Every white nationalist is two things at the exact same time. Hitler and Chicken Little. The hysteria that they say, oh, we're losing our culture. We're not. If these people had their way, Jackie Robinson would have never played baseball. And guess what? America would be worse off for it. We have to crush them like they've been crushed in the past.
It does appear that this guy's going to have a tough time getting confirmed.
I would like to see that pressed, though, because there are hundreds of this exact same guy
100%
all over the government right now. It started under Trump's first term, and they all need to be brought out like this in, you know, sunshine is the best disinfectant.
Should we do this Candace Owens thing?
I haven't seen it.
It is nuts. I don't know. Maybe we'll save it for Monday. But Candace Owens, I'll just tell people about it. Because it is fascinating to watch. And apparently, TPUSA has purged a lot of people from their organization who have questions about the assassination, have questions about like what has happened to the organization,
the direction
in the wake of
it,
all that stuff. So they're purging people. And Candace Owens, I think, is a bit of a lunatic. And, you know, chasing after clicks and this stuff. But apparently, according to Candace Owens, people can find, they've found a, and they've talked to this woman back, I think like 11, 12 years ago, Erica Kirk had this correspondence when she was 25 with a girl who was 15 or 16. And it was an odd, it was an odd correspondence. Now, I am not in a position to validate, like, if they show pictures of the text exchanges, and supposedly Candace Owens is talking to the woman.
I don't think it's the best fact-checking organization over at Candace.
Probably not. So it's hard to know. I can tell you that if it's an accurate representation of what went on, There could be a more innocent explanation for it, because, you know, who knows? But I will say that if it was a 25-year-old guy, and now, of course, that's different. It is different. But I don't know. It's weird. We don't have to play this. Maybe we'll do it. But... Crunchy, this voting rights bill is going to see a major uptick in Kirkinations. Like Matt often says, voting is supposed to be a pressure valve, and removing that valve is going to cause systematic eruptions of violence. I don't think this voting bill is going to pass in the Senate. Dan from Columbus, Matt, if we never let Jackie Robinson play baseball, you'd have a better chance of making it to the NBA. He debuted in 47 and NBA started integration in 1950. Fun fact for the day. I got another fun fact for the day.
The NBA wouldn't be cool then, though, and I wouldn't want to be in it.
I got another fun fact for you. Let's see if you know this. First team to have a black player.
Boston Celtics?
I know. Isn't that nuts?
Yeah.
First team to field a five black players at one time. Say it.
It's always who you least expect.
Boston Celtics. They just had the Coos on the other night. Was Bob Cousy's 50th anniversary. And that dude lived in Worcester. He went to Holy Cross, and then he lived in Worcester for years and years. And, like, we'd drive by his house, and, it wasn't a massive house. But
yeah,
for
contracts
Worcester,
weren't like they were now.
Right, but, I mean, for Worcester, it felt like, oh, it's got a stone wall around it and, like, a cul-de-sac driveway. You could see it from the road. I'm like, that's where Bob Cousy lives. Dmitra Bedev, due to population growth, African-American culture is the most imitated culture in human history.
Yeah. I mean, that's just definitely true, and currently, too, the way that...
But isn't that unfair to white people?
It's actually an attack on whiteness, and we all need... It's a making us weaker.
Jackie C. Bondi's cover-up of sexual abuse at Texas prison housing Ghislaine Maxwell. Democratic reps Raskin and Robert Garcia wrote to AG Bondi to grant them access to minimum security prison camp where Maxwell is being held. In a letter sent on Thursday, obtained by the New York Times, top Democrats on the House Judiciary and Oversight Committee say more than a dozen whistleblowers have come forward with what they describe damning information about Maxwell's treatment. They also said that congressional delegation should visit the prison camp in February to investigate allegations.
I mean, Bundy's response that it was actually
it's actually not preferential treatment, and it's not an easier place to be detained. But also, I had nothing to do with it and don't know who was. It's very similar to Pete Hegseth saying, yeah, those guys who killed the people in the boat, they did the exact right thing, but I wasn't in the room when it happened.
Exactly. Jersey Tom, Sam reading this ad like he's the neighbor from Home Improvement. I don't know what that means. Science is political. I just gave another $10 to Kat Abuzala for Illinois' 9th District. We need to support people to fight this big money. She just got, I think, endorsed by Justice Democrats, if I'm not mistaken, which is good. We've been trying to have her on for a while. I don't know, we keep missing it. Science is political. Is Brazil the only country more diverse than the USA?
It's got to be someone, one of the Americas.
The Mel Ryan, Trump would be cool with the gulag thing if it was Rosie O'Donnell. Matt from New Hampshire. We can criticize a candidate 2 years before an election like Gavin Newsom because we need to win. We can't criticize candidates in a primary like Jasmine Crockett in Tallarico because it'll ruin their chances for the general. We can't criticize a candidate in the general like Kamala Harris because the stakes are too high. We can criticize after the lost election because they didn't win. So what can they do? And God forbid we should criticize Obama. Kowalski from Nebraska. The U.S. government typically values an American life at $10 million in assessing the harm of a policy that's cost. The rollback of these regulations will not fundamentally change automobile manufacturers' design, which has the most pushback from the public and thus is most popular aspect of this rollback. But it functionally means nothing because if the U.S. wants to sell into foreign markets, they have to meet their environmental standards and they're not going to create a parallel production lines where they would just one global standards. This rollback, however, will allow for coal power plants to be built in the United States again. The Confederates had talked a lot about the Scotch-Irish roots to their narratives, as well as the Anglo-Saxon traditions. In Missouri, those guys met brutal Germany efficiency from immigrants that Benjamin Franklin thought could never assimilate into American culture. Tomo Flink. Happy Casual Friday, folks here in Britain. Starmer's sycophants are desperately trying to pretend that everything's fine regarding everything that's come to light regarding Lord Mandelson, while Starmer's team resigned one by one, with many senior labor figures calling for Starmer's resignation. Also, Sam, you're not the only one whose team embarrassed themselves this past weekend. In rugby, the men's Six Nations started this past weekend, and Wales lost our opening game away against England. Sorry about that. Kyle Leck. We got a lot of Anglo. So he wants America to be WASP only, which would explain why that Irish man in Trump's H blocks. Note, Scott Irish aren't Irish. They're Scottish, who moved to Ireland as part of the plantation system.
Right. Yeah.
Stephen Alaska loved the Matt rant about vaccines. Freaks every one of them. Last one of them. It was Wally Pipp, not Sandy Koufax. I'm sorry. Wally Pipp, it was not Sandy Koufax. It was Lou Gehrig. I keep forgetting. Sorry. I'm sunsetting, folks, particularly on a Friday. Dill, baby, Dill. Our national climate policy is turning, like when Hannity or whoever said they were going to turn their AC on and open the door. The GOP is acting like they placed a big Kalshi bet on sea level rises. When I was walking to work today, there was like a big cyber truck that was like waiting for me to cross the road. And I just looked at the thing and it's knee jerk. I have always found those things incredibly ugly and ridiculous. And I don't like big vehicles, whether they're gas guzzlers or not on the road. I just find it dangerous and I don't like it. But I was like, it's weird. It is an EV. And so it is like, you know, a positive development. I mean, it's, the truck itself is garbage and they're apparently, you know, cutting back on the production of it. But I'm like, boy, you know, Elon Musk. And I think he may have, in many respects, just exclusively his buying the presidency for Trump, set back the EV movement in this country, not even movement, like, you know, production for years and years, but he also by pushing for non-standardization so that he could maximize his profit probably also hurt it.
I mean, he was in the driver's seat of our economy as toward producing EVs as at the exact same time that China passed us for good, probably.
Yes, and you know all the high speed train. I mean, all that stuff. But still, I thought like, you know, this thing where it's like, you know, my reaction to it. I wonder, like, you know, should I temper my reaction because you know, just like any type of EVs at this point. And then I just remembered how much of a long-term project it was for Rush Limbaugh to like make EVs like you're a wimp, like you're like feminize it and make like it was relentless.
Prius.
It was relentless, relentless. His attacks on it.
Nice thing about the Cybertruck is you can sort of give all your scowls to those drivers and let the like Uber drivers who have Teslas off the hook because they just got the cars.
Well, I just find trucks that, first of all, that truck just looks ridiculous. It just looks stupid. And the size of it and the bulk of it is also stupid. And I mean, just in general, I find like the size of these pickup trucks so completely unnecessary. The F-150 can't even put a plow on that thing. Yet it's the size of like a small aircraft carrier. And, you know, you want hauling capacity. You want to be able to put, I mean, like the beds keep getting smaller. The trucks get bigger and the beds get smaller. So it's not like you're putting like sheets of plywood or drywall in it or something. I don't know. I just find it sort of obnoxious and ridiculous.
Big sign of how we failed as a country every time and someone drives it around.
The other dirty secret that you don't hear about is that if a vehicle is over 4,000 pounds, it gets a huge tax break. Huge tax break. Not if it's just a commercial vehicle. It gets a huge tax break. That's why we've encouraged these massive things. And of course, they add to pedestrian deaths, whatnot. Really cool. Please make sure Mamdani voter link is put in a YouTube description. It's not there yet. I'm a Zoran voter ready to participate. We will post that. Do you have it? This is the survey. The link will be in the YouTube and podcast description. Also, make sure, you know, that we put in that part about here, I'll send it to you. Because I want just like, you know, it's a high school student who's doing this. And we're not going to say his name or anything like that. Here, you can, I'm putting it into the, start with the second paragraph first. A high school student currently working a research project, a study. And the survey is intended for adults go that way. All right. I just put it. Oh, no. I just sent it to Dorsey. Sorry. I was in the wrong. I've been in the wrong. That explains that.
Maybe you're trying to message us up.
Yep. That explains a lot of stuff. Bear with me, folks. Oh, all right, hold on. I'll get to it in a second. Two more IMs. Oh, I'm going to go on vacation next week, folks. So I won't be back for a week. I'm going one last chance, last ditch chance to teach Saul to snowboard. So we're going up... going up north, and gonna do a little snowboarding, and we'll see. Because I figure I'm you know, like how many more years do I have to be able to do that? I can barely even bend down, tie my shoes.
You're gonna be sore when you do it too.
Oh God, Fabucat 58. Actually, the Hassan and Jennifer Welsh discussion was on her show. I've had it. Thank you. Oh, also, a link, and we should put this in. There's a flotilla that is going to Cuba to help the Cubans because we're starving them to death in many respects. Do you see that, Matt?
Do I see what?
Link?
I see the text. I didn't see the link.
I'll see if I can...
I can get the link from the sound sheet.
Okay. Do we have the link from the sound sheet?
I had it up earlier. I think I got it.
Okay, here it is. So check that out. Jersey Tom, who will you be taking out during your vacation? I would never give advance notice of that, of course. And the final I am of the week, appropriately from Jesus, I'm not coming back in 2027, but 20% of people will think that 6% of people will think that I will come back in 2027. Do that. Do with that as you will. Matt, great job this week doing double duty yesterday. Brian, great job. Emma, great job working through the illness. Dorsey, Kyle, Julie, Chris, Maria, Corey, Whitney. Great job this week, guys. Folks, we'll see you on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.